You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Okay, we're started. So welcome, everyone. My name is Scott Shepherd, the host of the City's First podcast. And myself and the City's First podcast are happy to kick off and host the inaugural episode of the City's First webinar. How creative. So the City's First webinar is very excited to have for our first episode the theme of decarbonization of the transport sector. And with that, we have three outstanding global thought leaders in the decarbonization and transport and urbanism sector, lending their voices to really this pressing issue in terms of the transformation of urbanism, as well as how we reach net zero. So with that, I'll just do some brief intros and bios, and then we'll just kick it off with the usual City's First format of going through our series of four or five questions and kind of have this roundtable discussion. So with that, just to give a little bit of background on who we're speaking with here, I first have Tia Gordon. So she's the Chief Operating Officer of It's Electric out of Brooklyn, New York City in the US. So we're really happy to have Tia with us. Next is Jennifer Lenhart, PhD. So she is Global Lead with WWF Cities. And I believe you're based in Chile right now, but normally you're based in Sweden. So she's joining us as well too. And then finally, we have Stephen Lorimer, who's the head of Clean Energy Cities at the Center for Net Zero. And Stephen, I believe you're based in UK. So with that, we're just gonna jump right in. We just have a really quick format here, and then we'll go through our topics, which I believe we've already posted on social media. So the first question, we're going to kick it off, is around, and then welcome everyone. Welcome Tia, Jennifer, and Stephen. We're really happy to have you here. So thank you. So with that, the first question I'm going to ask for Jennifer is, how can we transform the transport sector to meet our decarbonization goals?
That's a great and very big question, Scott. So how? I think it's there's no silver bullet answer on this. I mean, definitely EVs is a big part of that. I myself haven't owned a car since I was 16 and living in the United States. So I've been car free the whole time. So I think we need to put people first. And in cities, that's going to be a lot pertaining to walking, to cycling, certainly also access to a good public transport network. And when that is not available, to have access to good infrastructure for electric vehicles. Within WWF's perspective, we work with cities around the globe. We have something called the One Planet City Challenge, where we work with cities to do their data reporting. And then we see, you know, within that, which sectors do they need to address in order to align their cities to the Paris Agreement and the 1.5 degrees Celsius global warming target. And transportation is a big issue for cities. I mean, transportation globally is, I think, about 25% of our emissions. I'm a little rough on my statistics coming just off maternity leave. But, you know, in cities, it can be much, much more than that. And how we plan our city also influences what kind of transportation we use. I spent 5 years living in Amsterdam. I did my PhD research there. And every single time I got on my bicycle, I fell in love with that city all over again. So it wasn't just about getting me around my city, but creating a relationship with my city. And of course, sometimes it can rain. So So you put on a rain jacket. But at the same time, I recognize that I have been thankfully an able-bodied person, which means I could very easily get around my city on my bicycle or by walking. And so not everyone can do that. So we have to make sure that we have access to those different resources in order to really move forward. So I'm going to wrap up there because I want to make sure that Stephen has a chance to speak as well. But, you know, how can we transform? It's everything all at once. And there's not one singular solution for one singular city. You have to see it kind of collectively, but put people at the center. And then that's going to be a lot of it will come with walking and bicycling, but it will also be about a better public transportation grid and new technology, but also old technology. I'll stop there for now.
No silver bullet. Yeah, that's right.
No silver bullet. Lots of silver bullets.
All right, Stephen, what do you think?
Jennifer, you're tempting the question that always comes from interviewer, like, give me one silver bullet in summary. That's always the question that comes. So thanks for everyone having and great to be connected to someone in Stockholm. I went to an energy conference when I stayed in Hammarby Storstad and just to check out exactly what actually was going on in that neighborhood back in the 90s. We and Center for Net Zero are part of Octopus Energy, which is an energy supplier within 9 countries around the world. So we have a lot of data about how people have been using EV charging and low carbon technologies in general, because we are really centered on how the energy transition is going to be functioning in the future and how our research will fuel that. And the reason why I established Clean Energy Cities as a program within Center for Net Zero is because cities are going to be in the lead of the energy transition, just like they've been in the lead of the transition for transport. And these things will be very much tied together. And the electrification of transport is really one crucial part of the three ways that, and I'm going to quote Greg Clark, who's a great thinker and the chair of the Connected Places Catapult in here in the UK, of the three ways that kind of the decarbonization and decentralization of the energy sector kind of really feeds into how cities and transport work together. I mean, the first thing that you can do in cities that you can't do by taking a sector-based approach to either transport or energy or housing or anything else is behavior change. Like, cities can do behavior change and working with people like no other kind of body can. The second part is that cities, they can actually get co-benefits from electrification of transport into air quality, into the way that the tourism sector is going to improve in areas, because it's better quality of life and better streets and spaces to be inside, because it's not dirty and noisy in the future. And the third part is that you'll actually start to get cross-financing of investments in the electrification of transport, bi-directional charging, change in installation of charge points and other kinds of electrification of transport from all the other people that benefit from this. So those things are really start to come together to really push the electrification of transport as something that you just aren't going to be dependent on the transport sector or the energy sector to finance it itself. You can get the whole ecosystem of investments in a city to look at it as well. When we think about how people are going to be using EV charging in the future, you have to, first of all, as soon as you plug in an EV, it is 1,000 light bulbs. It is the scale of electricity use per minute that we don't normally think about when we, it's 8 times an appliance, like a washing machine. It's much bigger. So it's a big ticket item that you have to be very careful with the energy transition, because you will be fueled by renewable energy. You want EVs to be fueled by renewable energy, not by gas powered stations. So we need people to use their EVs in a way where they are using it when the sun is shining, when nuclear power is available in the evenings, and so we need to be able to do that as well. And I think we'll touch on that with automation in the future. The other part is that an EV battery can power a house for a week, and so when you actually have stress on an electricity grid, the temptation, the quotation marks of energy networks to fire up those coal power stations, fire up other things because it's a peak demand that's happening. That's the opportunity for almost kind of infinite number of microgrids to start happening from EV batteries EV batteries fueling buildings in the future. And inside here in the UK, for example, there's a lot of policy developments around what's called vehicle DAX technology. How do you actually have vehicles connected to the grid or to buildings or to any other kind of assets that you have in the built environment to either charge them to be used for transport or actually be a resource when energy is scarce. And that is kind of one of the big revolutions that we'll have from transport, because people will be buying electric vehicles or investing in electric buses, not because it's a energy resource, because it's a utility, and the battery is like there available as something that is almost an added extra, which will help power our cities in the future. So that's this real kind of opportunity that we have between those, and especially in big global north cities and kind of really growing global south cities. You know, we have different kind of recommendations how they approach the energy transition and transport at the same time. We could be talking about EV charging districts where, you know, only EVs are allowed to help balance the energy grid and make them more available. You could be talking about allowing access to buildings that have a lot of rooftop solar for EV charging that is really cheap because it's more than what the building could generate. So you have those kinds of suggestions that you have for cities that try to integrate the transport sector into the energy sector, into the rest of the built environment as part of the energy transition.
Positive externalities and behavioral change. I think those are the two takeaways I got at a very high level. I think that really can lead this transition. So thank you, Stephen, for that. That's really important stuff. So the next question I'd like to hand this off to Tia is, what modes will get us to net zero quickest?
Thanks, Scott. So I love saying the expression, everything, everywhere, all at once. And I think that's definitely what we need to do. I'm an odd bird. I've started an EV charging company. I live in New York City. I live in Brooklyn. I live in an apartment, but I cycle everywhere. And, you know, I've been stuck behind very, very, very poor emissioned qualified buses. I've been stuck behind cars. And so my desire to, you know, bring EV charging into cities is not to bring more cars onto the street. That's not the goal here. The goal is to help move everyone to cleaner forms of transportation as fast as possible. So that's cycling, that's walking, but that also is taking the existing transportation that exists and making sure that we can convert that to electric in the fastest way possible, the most scalable way possible. So for me, to be able to do this, you know, we need to think about what's being left on the table in terms of EV charging in the United States. And that's the 40 million drivers who live in cities who do not have access to driveways or garages. 80% of all EV charging right now happens at home. And that assumption is that those homes have that off-street parking, but they don't, not when you live in a city. So right now, what has happened is that there's been this huge wealth barrier that's been erected if you wanted to drive electric vehicles in the city. I want to actually start to remove even the cost component of electric vehicles. There was a great redaction in the LA Times put in, I think, a day or two ago that pointed out that we have to stop talking about sort of like the average purchase price of a new EV and assuming that we're using high-end Tesla and Polestar. You can get a Chevy Bolt, for example, using the federal subsidy for $20,000 right now. So, you know, we don't need to kind of hold the price point of EVs as the barrier. The barrier in cities right now is charging. So it's really about trying to create ways for people to be able to charge in cities where they're not having to pay, for example, in a borough like Manhattan, $800 a month for a spot in a garage that has an EV charger. So how do we find solutions that bring equity to the EV charging equation? And that is a big part of the factor of how cities can start to move greener, faster, everywhere.
Reduce that barrier to entry and kind of move beyond kind of the paradigm, which is that it's just the price point for the vehicles and the actual physical infrastructure. So really great point. So Jennifer, what are your thoughts on this same question?
Well, I love that Tia mentioned that she's a cyclist working on EV technology, which is fantastic. And it's definitely a key part of the solution here. Given that there's so much passion for it, I will just take a different side of the discussion and just, you know, to remind us of the importance of interconnectivity between cities. You know, Europe is having kind of a revitalization about on rail and especially high-speed rail. And how can we bring that? Because that's a very important part of transport nodes. I know we're talking a lot about cities here, but people don't just stay in the city. I mean, for me, one of the greatest things about living in the city is to get out of the city and then come back and be so happy that I live in the city. At the moment, I find myself in Santiago, Chile, and there's also a discussion about revitalizing their rail. It's a very long country. They would be very much benefited from a stronger rail system, but it's not the case right now. In Sweden, where I'm normally based, there's a big push to stay on the ground. And in order to stay on the ground, you need to have access to that good rail. And then once you get to the train station, that you can then move around. And whether it's by micromobility solutions that are quickly accessible, or when you're a tourist, or whether you're walking, or if you're living there and you have an EV, in either of those countries, I haven't owned a car. But what we have benefited from is car sharing systems. And so when Tia's speaking, I'm starting to think, you know, how that's great. I wish we had access to here in Santiago in Chile to electric cars to when we're doing car sharing systems. Right now we don't, but hopefully we will soon. Being inspired by a lot of these other cities. So again, I think it's really about connectivity. Being that we are a global organization working with cities around the globe, yeah, there are no silver solutions. But you know, it's really about learning and sharing and seeing how each of these connects to a bigger city puzzle.
And one size certainly does not fit all. I think it has to be region specific, contextual specific, city specific, et cetera. So we can't take Absolutely. This copy paste approach. So the next question, I think we're having a nice healthy pace here, is around electrification autonomy. So the question is, I'll hand this off to you again, Tia, is how do we leverage electrification and autonomy tech for the greater good? Very broad question.
All right. I'm not going to take the autonomy side of this. I'm sure. going to take the greater good side okay. of this.
No problem.
And I'm not going to make them, you know, mutually exclusive, but I'm going to go on the greater good side. you know, so I talked about equity earlier and the idea that EVs are definitely considered right now. And there's a popular opinion that those who own EVs are concerned about the environment, but they're also largely white and wealthy, right? So how do we start to change that equation? How do we start to change that perception? And also, how do we take this notion of the green economy and make that feel accessible to everyone on every level? So what's not an endorsement for It's Electric, but what we're looking to do in the way that we deploy chargers is we are using energy that is already there. We're using a behind the meter approach. So we're basically, instead of connecting our chargers to utility connections in the street and creating that long-term permitting and cost process, we avoid that because we are pulling power from building power that's already there directly from an adjacent building, regardless of typology. And then we run that by a simple conduit to the sidewalk. And to go into equity, why would a building let us do this? Because we are then going to revenue share back to them. So right now there's a big pushback that happens in a lot of cities in regards to the notion of gentrification. If an EV charger pops up in a neighborhood, people feel like there's, you know, certain assumptions that are being made, and maybe it's not welcome. But if we're able to put up our chargers, especially, you know, only in a city like New York, where I'm calling in from today, only 16% of charging infrastructure is in outer boroughs where most of rideshare drivers live. So let's talk about the fact that Mayor Adams here in New York City has had the mandate now that both Uber and Lyft have to be all electric by 2030. And whereas those actual rideshare companies are working on the financing mechanisms and the rental mechanisms by which these drivers can drive electric, where are they going to charge? I've seen statistics that say that drivers are losing up to $250 a week in the time that they're taking to find centralized DC fast charging stations. And that's a huge amount of money when you're a rideshare driver. So you know, part of what we're looking to do is to put in chargers in neighborhoods and on the blocks where rideshare drivers already live, so that they can basically charge where they park, right? So their habits are the same. They don't have to add different layers of context to their routines. And what we can do is, with a charger in these neighborhoods, we can help offset, by our calculations, if a single charger is utilized just 20% of the day, that house that we're pulling power from, and this is level two, just to speak to Stephen's point earlier, it's not level three. So we're not using 10,000 light bulbs. We're using closer to an electric dryer's load of energy. Yeah. You know, so if we have that charger running just 20% of the day, we're offsetting, let's say, a one or two families' home's annual electric bill by 80%. And that's a huge difference in the pockets of New Yorkers. So there's a whole opportunity out there in terms of how to leverage the green economy for everyday individuals, for everyday citizens, and not just on a high level business and government level.
And just before I hand it off to Stephen, so use kind of New York and the five boroughs as an example here, and thinking about equity, access, and availability of the ubiquity of electric charging stations. It's very, if you were to overlay a map of the ubiquity or availability of micromobility to what we're talking about with EV charging stations and clusters in certain boroughs in New York or in other areas, and a lack of access to more of the outer boroughs or other areas. These are opportunities for cities, like Stephen was saying, to basically reinforce behavioral change, and for the greater good of the theme of this question is looking at these, let's say, you know, EV charging deserts or micromobility deserts. Yes. And trying to stimulate or encourage investment in these areas to achieve these policy goals, I think it's really key. Or that's certainly from my own perspective. I know you guys are the panelists, but I wanted to lay in my own opinion, because I think that's important too. But Stephen, what are your thoughts on how do we leverage electrification and or autonomy for the greater good?
Tia did tempt fates, but it's, first, it's like really good to share a platform with New York. I was born in the hospital my parents met in Manhattan. So it's like, it's a special place to me. I'll be there in a month. I'll be there in a month and see people there. I'll tempt it by going kind of towards like how you actually build the business case for autonomy and for automation in charging and building that up over time. We in Clean Energy Cities really say like the data needs to be available to build up an energy system that works for the greater good when renewable energy is being used, when it's being and you have a clean energy system in the future. And one of those is to build a local energy market that works. So our sister company, Kraken Flex, which is a utility flexibility software company, they did a project with Innovate UK, which is a government-owned entity that promotes innovation and business in the UK with grants. And what they did is they produced a local energy market platform that looked at if you have bidirectional charging or heat pumps or PVs on your homes, you might be signing up to a tariff that is dynamic in the future, that kind of peaks when it's most expensive in the evening, because that's the most expensive wholesale rate that we have in the energy system. And it's cheaper when there's a lot of renewable energy system in the daytime, or cheaper when there's less demand in the evening. And when they thought that the behavior change that would come out of this, or people there that had these kinds of compliant tariffs, would result in a $40 million a year savings for the local energy system. And that translates to £30 a year for the average utility bill for everyone. So it's almost like everyone saved on the reinforcement costs of upgrading the electricity grid for transport, just from people signing up to these kinds of tariffs and their behavior change of using, of charging their vehicles when they're when it's cheaper, for instance, and taking that pressure off the grid at those peak times. They also found that there's about £4.5 billion of investments in charging and in the building stock, into PVs, into heat pumps inside the building stock, that and $2 billion of which wouldn't have happened otherwise without having these kinds of this local energy market platform. And that was over the course of the next 15 years. So there's these examples of actually building up the kind of kind of tears that people voluntarily sign up to save them money and save the planet as well. And also thinking about, you know, what happens behind the meter as well. And we're actually developing a project with Tech London Advocates and trying to find a test bed within London with the commercial real estate sector, where their solar rooftop investments can be redirected towards EV charging on the streets and kind of turn off the connection to the grid and turn on a private connection to that building. And because what happens right now is there's a lot of what's called curtailment of renewable energy, where the network says, we cannot accept any more export into the grid. Please turn off all of your solar panels, not even to your building, so we can ensure the stability of the grid. In a place like Arizona, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory found that about 14% of their electricity capacity could be covered by solar, but about 10% of that solar is curtailed right now. And that's a very, you know, compared to low uptake to what we want in the future, where we want that number to be in the 70s and 80%. So this problem will increase more and more. And we know that ESG commitments of corporates is really pushing for buildings to start to build solar power onto buildings to kind of as an investment to meet their sustainability goals. So this is accelerating more and more. And we know there's an opportunity to have EVs being, you know, EVs in commercial areas of cities to have cheap charging, because these buildings are suddenly getting something for nothing. Because before they were getting nothing from it before. So we think that there's models like this that can be tested in, especially in kind of into really dense cities that have congested grids in the future.
Excellent. Well, thank you for sharing that perspective on, you know, the theme of the greater good and what are the opportunities there. So kind of our final question, I think we might have time to have all you guys give your thoughts on that. We're a little ahead of schedule here. So this is a little bit more at the city level now. And the question, I'll field this to Jennifer first, is can we strengthen public transport and urban design to create a paradigm shift in the sector?
Thank you, Scott. And I'd actually like to start on the urban design part first and add a few kind of framing statistics, if you will. So cities and urban areas are responsible for 70% of carbon emissions, 75% of natural resource use, and a lot of the emerging cities that we're seeing around the globe are happening in so-called biodiversity hotspots. So if anyone wondered why an organization like WWF is in a call like this, it's because the connection between urban areas and nature is very real, and it's more complex every day. I also like that Tia brought up the aspect of equity. And what we've also seen looking at cities around the world is between 40 to 60% of cities, the public space in cities is dedicated to cars in the form of roads and highways and parking lots. So at WWF, we'd like to see, now, of course, this is a bit idealistic, but that's my role here, is, you know, what kind of urban design we'd like to see streets for people in nature. So I have this great graphic that sometimes I use, and it's a city in London, and you roll out a green carpet and you green the walls, and you know, you bring out the people and the nature into the public space as well as the cars. And so I think this is one of the things that we're talking about, is really how can we create these shared spaces for people. But still, mobility is a key aspect of our lives. And I think something we really missed when we were all locked away in COVID. And so I think, you know, the role of public transportation is extremely relevant here, as well as biking, as well as walking, as well as having your own electric vehicle, et cetera. So I think I'm going to just bring one point in that Stephen also mentioned, and that's behavior change. We are launching a new report from WWF to work with local policymakers on behavior change tactics, in particular looking at transportation as well as on urban food consumption, and kind of what can local city leaders do to help push people in a more positive direction. And I think one of the things that you always see in the behavior change literature is if you want to get people to use public transportation, it has to be safe. It has to be affordable. It has to be frequent. It has to be close. It needs to be clean. Without any of those aspects, I think it's a real difficulty to get to really encourage anyone but the kind of hardcore tree huggers to get on the bus, and or people that don't have any other option. And we don't want it to be that, okay, you have no other option, so you have to get on the bus. I think there's a great quote from the former mayor of Bogota saying that, you know, a rich city is where people choose to use public transportation. And I think this is something that we need to flip the script, that that should be the preferred alternative. And then if you have to use a car, that's also okay. And especially, you know, for further distances or depending on what you're carrying. I mean, I'm not car anti-car, but I'm pro people and pro nature, of course. So I think that's sort of what I would see as an ideal shift and how to link in urban design to public transportation and to have the people aspect included.
Well said. No, you hit some great themes here. We're running out of time, so I can't add myself. So, Stephen, maybe just 1 or 2 minutes, your thoughts, and then Tia as well, too, so we can get your perspectives on this question, then we'll start wrapping up.
Jennifer, your comment about the rich on public transport is a sign of a great city. That I think in the UK, they always use a meme of Paul McCartney sitting on a train for that. I think people have seen that a few times. First, on the public transport side of things, electric bus networks is a huge part of investment, which is being promoted by, and especially in the global south, in kind of cities that try to have a first move that we kind of recommend within clean energy cities. For example, the C40 climate finance facility is investing about has about 30 million investment that it's having in across cities. For example, in Jakarta, they built a case study where we actually looked at it for the Connected Places catapults in the UK to see how emerging markets are actually using renewable energy effectively in the future. One of the difficulties they have is that the district really gets put under pressure by kind of fast charging of electric buses, because we're talking about 450 kilowatts as opposed to as the gold standard to be able to charge buses in the future. And then you have to start asking from an equity point of view, a lot of kind of different favors of turn down of heating or turn out of the air conditioning in the surrounding area to allow the bus depot to function as efficiently as it could. So those are kind of problems that they're already starting to encounter after kind of investing into a fleet of 8 and a fleet of 80 over the past 10 years. In places like London, if you total up all the commitments from the 33 boroughs of London, you'll find out that 60% of streets are designated for EV charging, because that's to make up the deficit that we have of off-street parking and charging that will be there. That's a huge investment opportunity across the sector, but also a huge challenge of how it's being used at the time and how actually people can use automation effectively in the future. And that's the effect, of course, on the urban design of the place, because we have this paradox that I want to close with, that we've been trying to remove clutter and remove street furniture. We've been trying to remove things from footpaths and sidewalks of streets. And now we're talking about, because we want to balance the energy system, the energy grid inside the congested areas of cities, we want to put all this back in to allow EV charging to happen. And we need to recognize this paradox, which has started to emerge, which gets pointed out every single time. These are the places that highest pressure onto everything in the city, people walking, space, and of course, like the electricity grid, are all kind of wrapped up in the same area. No surprise that the city is under pressure in the same area for lots of different reasons.
Conflicting goals and aims, yes. So we'll give Tia kind of the last take on your perspective related to this question, then we'll wrap up.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts. Do you mind repeating the question? I just want to reframe it a little
bit. Sure, no problem. So can we strengthen public transport and urban design to create a paradigm shift? Is it possible? And what are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. As I mentioned, I cycle a lot in New York City, but most of my cycling is done on City Bike. I think that the transformation that City Bike has created in a city like New York has been astounding. As someone who has cycled in New York City for 25 years and has been hit by cars several times, you know, the idea that even we would have dedicated bike lanes in a city like New York 15 years ago was unfathomable. So the fact that we have made this transition because of the vision and the leadership that we had during the Bloomberg administration and continues to be developed through the power of the DOT and other sort of benefactors of clean transportation in New York City has been incredible. So for me, you know, it's from the next shift that I think we would need to really consider, which is already starting to happen, is thinking about the users more of public transportation. And I wish I had some statistics around this, because we really plan around a single user in terms of modality when we're thinking about public transportation in cities. And now that's starting to shift. So for example, New York City buses now allow for parents to bring strollers onto the buses without collapsing them, which is a really obviously smart move, because if you have a stroller, you are usually burdened with not only the child that's in the stroller, but your packages, your groceries, and anything else that you can really jam in there. And the idea that to get on the bus, you have to unload all of that, collapse the stroller, carry the child, carry all those packages and the stroller onto the bus, is really daunting. So, you know, it's moves like that that can really help make public transportation not only more accessible, but more desirable to be used by the public. And that also leads me to think about, you know, individual modes of modality in terms of how to move families around cities. It's not just moving the individual. I think there's a great company out of the Netherlands called We with an exclamation point at the end, and they have a family cargo bike subscription model, which I would love to see something like that come to Brooklyn, because the number one factor that moves people into vehicles is usually when they start to have families, because they need to then be able to safely transport their children. So how do we make the transport of children a key factor for cities in their consideration? And so that's something that I really like to think about and really like to imagine as new modes of possibility. I'm not saying that we have to have these major shifts where we have, you know, autonomous driverless mini cars that are constantly moving around dedicated, you know, routes and monorail systems. There can be smaller shifts that can happen that can make public transportation a lot more useful, especially for parents and for working parents.
Less robo-taxis, more shared cargo bike subscriptions. They're based in Oslo, Norway, so I know them.
Thank you. Okay.
Great platform, great offer. Mm-hmm. And incremental change and something that's much more locally based and aligned with tactical urbanism and things that are DIY that we can all do together. So with that, we'll close out. So thank you, Tia. Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you, Stephen. And thank you everyone for joining. We're really excited to have everyone here today on our first episode. So look for this in all of our episodes on social media. I'll share links for Tia, Jennifer, Stephen, where you can find them, as well as where you can, follow up for, any Q&A or any other deep dives. But again, really excited about this topic and hope to have you guys again soon, maybe for part two or another topic. So it's been a real pleasure and an honor to have you here today. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Scott.
All right. And thank you, everyone. And look for our next episode. We'll pivot back to the city's first podcast, not webinar, in May. And we have some exciting guests. We kind of alternate between US, UK, and Europe. And we'll continue with our theme of cities first. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you.